good afternoon. Monday, December 3rd, 2018. First Monday in December, 14 minutes past the hour. You're tuned into the Now program. Scott Spears along with you for the ride. Now, coming up tomorrow, we have a, well, let me say this. Tomorrow on the program, we have a very special guest who I'm going to announce before the program is over today, but it's a show you're not going to want to miss. Now, coming up next hour, we are going to be joined by one of my favorite guests. He's a many-time visitor to this program. He has won more primetime Emmys than any other male in the history of the Emmy Awards. You probably know him best as Lou Grant. Ed Asner, next hour, 1:10 to 2 p.m. But this hour, we are going to do something that certainly needs to be done, but you hate to see anybody pass away. Over the weekend, Friday night, late Friday night, we lost the 41st President of the United States, George Bush, at the age of 94. This hour, to help us remember him, is famed historian Douglas Brinkley. Douglas, how are you?
I'm doing fine. Thanks for having me.
Douglas, Friday night, just before midnight, when you heard of President Bush's passing, what was the first thing that ran through your head?
Well, I'm the historian for CNN, and my first thing that ran through my head was, oh my gosh, my whole calendar has just changed, because I knew I would have to be reflecting on his extraordinary life and times. When I got to thinking about President Bush proper, I immediately come to the end of the Cold War. You know, I was born in 1960, and the Cold War was the backdrop of my entire childhood, teenage years, college years. I never thought I'd live to see the day when I was young of the collapse of the Soviet Union. But when Bush 41, as we call him, was in office, that happened in 1991. The entire Soviet Union collapsed. We had a whole spat of new republics that were pro-American and were declaring their allegiance to the West. We had the Berlin Wall come down in 1989 and German reunion. And so we call really the Bush years revolution. Their book's called The Revolution of 1898 about what occurred in 1989. I mean, the revolution of 1989. And, you know, Bush was at the front and center of all this. And he had a velvet glove when it came to diplomacy. His time spent as an envoy in China and as an ambassador to the United Nations had taught him well the skills needed to be a diplomat. And he was able to bring our country and the world through potentially perilous times into a better place by 1992. So it's this foreign policy that I think we're going to remember the most.
He, of course, was Ronald Reagan's vice president for 8 years. He comes in when Reagan is up. His two terms are up. What are the big differences between Ronald Reagan and the George Bush presidency?
Well, I was lucky enough to be given Ronald Reagan's White House diaries by Nancy Reagan, and the arrangement was made by Pete Wilson, former governor of California. And so I came into the Reagan Library, and one of the things I noticed from Ronald Reagan's daily diaries during his presidency was how close he was to George Herbert Walker Bush. The media had made it seem like the Bushes and the Reagans were kind of feuding. There was some tension between Nancy Reagan and Barbara Bush, but Ronald Reagan and George Bush got along incredibly well. They had a weekly lunch where they discussed the world, and Reagan would always turn to Bush for some advice, particularly on foreign policy. So it was a very loyal relationship, Reagan and Bush. Their styles were quite different. You know, Reagan could turn populist very easily. I think, you know, he was born in Illinois. His father was an alcoholic. He didn't have any money. They struggled through the Great Depression. By moving out to Hollywood and becoming a star, he learned how to be charismatic in front of TV cameras and how to give an extraordinary speech. George Herbert Walker Bush was born into a lap of luxury. His father, Prescott Bush, was a senator from Connecticut. They had a lot of wealth. He went to Andover and Yale. He got to go, was a millionaire on his own in the oil industry in Texas by the age of 40. And so they were different people. I think Reagan was a better communicator than George Herbert Walker Bush. Bush was, though, the epitomized what some people used to call the WASP culture, white Anglo-Saxon, East Coast, New England ways. Some people call it the Eastern Establishment. Then it's or the Council on Foreign Relations crowd. Some today call it the Deep State. But he was he epitomized a kind of center-right, steady governance. And Reagan could be, you know, a little more radical than Bush on his conservative agenda. Bush liked to operate dead center as often as he could.
Would President Bush be considered a Republican today?
He is. There are, you know, funny ass, that's a great question, because before I got on this show, I was just musing, who is a Bush 41 Republican today? I would say John Kasich of Ohio, the governor, is. Jeff Flake, the outgoing senator from Arizona. Maybe Susan Collins, the senator from Maine, who is very close to the Bush family. Lisa Murkowski, maybe, from Alaska. Maybe even Mitt Romney would be a Bush 41 type. They're there in the Republican Party, but their ranks have shrunk. And, you know, there's not a lot of, you know, people that are saying, I'm a Bush Republican out there right now. We call it a dynasty, the family, because of the odd specter of having a father and son as president. But on the real political trail and the huskings of America, Reagan looms much larger. People will say, I'm a Reagan Republican. They don't often say, I'm a Bush Republican.
Interestingly enough, on Friday night before President Bush passed away, I happened to be watching a show on Ronald Reagan, in which President Bush had been interviewed for, and a lot of talk is made, Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall, the meetings, the summits that Gorbachev and Reagan had, but the fall of the Soviet Union happened under Bush when he was president. The Berlin Wall came down under Bush. Would it have happened had there not been a George Bush after Reagan?
Well, I think that perestroika and glasnost within the USSR was already occurring, and so I probably would have collapsed. But what I would say Bush did perfect is guide us through the uncertainty, because that was who knew if German reunification, for example, would work. Who knew if there would be bloodshed on the streets of Berlin? Who knew if there wouldn't be a counter-revolution in Russia? There was a lot of uncertainty, and Bush did the right thing by being prudent and cautious, and he never grandstand. One of the stories that's circulating the last few days is Condoleezza Rice saying that she rushed in to see Bush 41 when the wall came down and said, we need to get to Berlin. And Bush said, for what, to dance on the wall? Why do we need to be in Berlin? This is a German problem. We're monitoring it 24/7, but it's not our time to gloat or pound our chest or say we won the Cold War, because you can be a fool very quickly, because currents of history change on a daily, weekly basis. So he kind of was a steadfast leader through those turbulent times, and I'm not sure Reagan or somebody like Bill Clinton could have done it as well as Bush did, because he had traveled the world so widely and had really, he knew every foreign leader. He knew all the people in our State Department embassies. His best friend was Secretary of State James Baker. So he had Brent Scowcroft, a great Air Force general at National Security, one of his closest friends. His team did a remarkably good job on handling that moment when the world was topsy-turvy.
It's very interesting. We look at first ladies. We know Eleanor Roosevelt played a part in Franklin's presidency. Nancy Reagan, we now know, played a big part in Reagan's. Certainly Hillary Clinton in Bill Clinton's presidency. Barbara Bush, it was an interesting thing. When George Bush was voted out, we learned that Barbara Bush was pro-choice. That was a big story for a long time. How big of a part did she play in his presidency?
Barbara Bush is a gigantic figure in George Bush's life. I don't know if her influence was as much on policy-related issues as it was on, she had a great BS detector, and she knew who had her husband's back and who didn't. She held the family grudges, so if you insulted her husband, she didn't forget. By personality and predilection, Bush 41 would kind of shrug it off as just part of politics. Barbara Bush wasn't wired that way. And so she was kind of an enforcer of things. But I don't think that she was the first lady that you can compare to Eleanor Roosevelt, who was so active in women's rights and wrote a My Day column weekly and traveled the world during World War II, visiting wounded soldiers in hospitals, and became the leader of the United Nations Declaration of Human Rights. Barbara Bush really wasn't a political activist personality. What she was a family matriarch, and she did that exceedingly well.
Even though we all remember Read My Lips, No New Taxes, at the end of 1991, as we headed into the re-election campaign of President Bush, sitting President Bush, he had an approval rating of 90%. The Gulf War had went extremely well. We talked about all the things he had done abroad with the Berlin Wall, the Soviet Union collapsing. What happened in those 11 months that went from 90% approval to not reelected?
That is such an important question. It seemed like he should automatically get reelected, but fate played an ugly hand on his political career. First off, he went to Japan, and back then we were really warring with Japan over automobiles and tariffs and the like, and he threw up in the lap of the Japanese leader, and it was a very embarrassing moment. Then Pat Buchanan, this upstart Republican, ran a kind of pitchfork revolution, a hard right, kind of John Birch-like group, maybe today we call it the alternative right, said, I'm going to challenge Bush, and Buchanan caused all sorts of problems for George Bush. Then Ross Perot, the Texas billionaire from Dallas, had a grudge against the Bush family and decided, I'm going to run as an independent, money be damned, and threw himself into the race. He did so well, Pro, that he got to be part of the presidential debates. And so it was kind of Perot and Clinton beating up on the sitting president, Bush 41, in the debates. With all of that said, the real problem was the economy. You know, James Carville's famous dictum, it's the economy, stupid. The economy wasn't doing well. And Bush didn't really have a solution. There's that one time up in New Hampshire, Bush came in front of a big crowd and basically read off a cue card and said, I'll get things better, without really offering how are things going to get better economically. And Clinton came up there in New Hampshire and said, I feel your pain. You know, he exuded Clinton empathy for people struggling during an economic downturn. And Bush seemed annoyed that the economy wasn't doing well on his watch. And then I get to that watch moment of the debate when he stares at his watch like he wanted to leave the debate stage. And this now was the age of cable TV and, you know, newsreel bites. And, you know, that kept being played over and over again. He didn't perform well on the debates. The economy wasn't doing well. Perot got 19% of the vote, largely on trashing Bush's NAFTA trade agreement. And Bill Clinton was a very good candidate and represented a new, younger generation, replacing the World War II generation. And alas, he lost.
You know, interestingly enough, your network, CNN, last night ran the story of the 1992 election. And in that program, it's almost assumed that Perot was taking votes away from both Bush and Clinton, and they were both happy when he got out of the race for that period of time that he did before he got back in at the end. Do you think he hurt Bush more than Clinton?
100% Perot hurt Bush more than Clinton, because he had a singular issue he was focused on, and that was NAFTA. And that was Bush's economic program, and yet the economy wasn't doing well. And when you're a sitting president, you don't want to share stages with people. You don't want, no sitting president wants to debate two other people, because you're the power source. You're the one really arriving with the Secret Service entourage, and you can fly Air Force One into a debate, and you have the trappings of power. And now you have two competitors taking swipes at you. And the fact that they were both from Texas, here is a rich family, George Herbert Walker Bush, who's very wealthy, and now somebody wealthier, a Texas billionaire, charges Bush with not bringing back our POWs and MIAs from the Vietnam War. And it was an onslaught. I think it hurt. Perot, though, only hurt as much as Pat Buchanan did. A sitting president doesn't like to have a challenger. And even at the Republican convention, Buchanan went rogue and started, pushing his very, far-right agenda forward, which turned off a lot of centrists who said, you know what, I don't like Clinton, so I'll vote for Ross Perot. If you go and talk to most Perot voters that are around, you'll find that if they had a push come to shove, they would have voted Bush over Clinton.
Talk about the Clinton-Bush race. Clinton wins, goes on for two terms, and then once they're both out of office, Bush and Clinton, a friendship develops. Was this a real friendship, and what spurred it?
The friendship was how gracious Bush 41 was in defeat. He gave one of the great speeches on that election night after losing, and then he wrote that famous note for Bill Clinton saying, I'm not one to give advice, I'm on your side, call on me if you need me. He was very gracious to Bill Clinton. He didn't try to score points on Bill Clinton when he was going through scandals, the Monica Lewinsky event and the like, his impeachment woes. And so they became friends, and it was largely to kind of say, we are part of a ex-president's club, to give a bipartisan cast in America. I mean, Bush 41 saw Gerald Ford and Jimmy Carter become best friends, so much so that when Gerald Ford died, the chief eulogist was Jimmy Carter, even though Carter had defeated Ford. And so even though Bill Clinton had defeated Bush, he took a page from his old friend Jerry Ford and formed a friendship with Bill Clinton. And they had, oddly, had a shared sense of humor. And on events like Hurricane Katrina or problems with, typhoons and the like, when we needed humanitarian relief, they would pool together and try to make it seem like an American cause. Barbara Bush was less fond of Bill Clinton, but 41 generally enjoyed time with him, enjoyed his company, and I would call it a genuine friendship in the end.
Interestingly enough, Clinton defeats Bush. Bush does not get a second term, and then at the end of the Clinton years, the next president is George Bush's son, George W. Bush. Did George Bush want his family to be in politics? Did he like that idea?
He wanted his sons to be part of the American dream, part of public service, contribute to good governance. I don't think any person wishes the degradation of running for office in America when every aspect of your life is being looked into and you get brutalized. In George W. Bush's sense, his father knew he had a problem with alcoholism early in life and cocaine, and had some wild years, and those were going to all come out. But yes, he, in the end, was very proud of both George W. and Jeb for wanting to be the best, for wanting to make America a better place. And in that way, it is a dynasty. You know, Joe Kennedy was a lot tougher on his kids, really dreaming that one day one of them would be president, the first Catholic president, and he fought for that, Joe Kennedy. I do not think George Herbert Walker Bush did that with his sons, but he led them. He showed them by example paths where you can go into politics and not lose your personal integrity. And he was exceedingly proud that George W. Bush won. And, you know, you mentioned Bill Clinton. The big mistake Al Gore made in 2000 was not inviting Bill Clinton to campaign with him. Al Gore was ashamed of being vice president for Clinton due to Monica Lewinsky and other problems and with sexual harassment and the like. So Gore shunned Clinton, and in retrospect, Clinton had a lot of popularity in him still, and if Gore would have said, yes, I am the VP that brought you a balanced budget and actually a surplus in the economy, and we're not at war, and the tech industry is on fire in America, it would have been better for Gore to have wrapped his arms around Clinton. So Clinton and Gore were estranged when George W. Bush became president, and it gave Clinton an opportunity to get to know George W. In a way that Al Gore has never become friends with George W. Bush.
Interestingly enough, George W. Bush does serve two terms, but during that time we have Hurricane Katrina, which George W. is blamed for. The Iraq War becomes very unpopular. The crash of the housing market. When by the time George W. Bush left office, his approval ratings were at record lows. And we learned that he did not consult his father much. Was there much consultation with the father?
No, they really kept it very separate. In fact, one of the great ironies of history is that George Herbert Walker Bush successfully ran the Gulf War in 1991, Operation Desert Shield, over 230,000 U.S. troops participating in it, plus other troops from around the world. And we could say the United States won the Gulf War in 91. We met our objective. We did not win the Iraq War under George W. Bush. Mission creep set in. Bush, 43, became too Wilsonian in the sense that he thought the United States could make the world safe for democracy, and somehow the United States was going to run Baghdad and deal with the problems of thousands of years for Shiites, Sunnis, and Kurds and the like, and it became an utter disaster. Bush 41 was skeptical about intervention of his son, but his son did things his way. He had been commander-in-chief for 9/11. George W. Bush saw that as an act of war, and instead of focusing on Saddam Hussein and Afghanistan, he floated the idea that Saddam had weapons of mass destruction, and it turned out there were no weapons of mass destruction, and it just became an albatross around the neck of George W. Bush, the Iraq War. We do short wars well in America, but if it's a war of choice, meaning we're not declared war on us, but it's a presidential choice to go to war, we're impatient. You need to get something done in a year or two. It can't drag on for 6 or 7 years. That's the lesson of Vietnam, and I'm afraid George W. Bush did not learn the right lesson out of Vietnam. He might be able to have gotten out of the basement of history, George W. Bush, if the economy didn't tank on him, and we had the Great Recession on his watch. Whether fairly or unfairly, when an economy takes a nosedive and you're the sitting president, blame comes your way.
George H.W. Bush spent 26 years as a former president. What kind of a former president was he? How did he spend those years?
He had a great love of the city of Houston, Texas. And I'm a professor at Rice University there, and I can tell you he cast a very large shadow in that community. You land into Bush International Airport and go down Bush Boulevard, and there's a giant statue of Bush in the airport of him on a runway with a suitcase in one hand and a suit coat over his shoulder. Any major charity fundraiser, whether it's for, you know, MD Anderson Cancer, the Heart Institute, or the Fine Arts Museum, there was George Herbert Walker Bush. he played baseball at Yale, and he was loved Major League Baseball, so he was a regular presence at the Astros games and Houston Texan games in the NFL. And then the summers he had in Maine, and he was kind of the greatest invitation if you spend your summers in Maine is getting to visit with the Bushes, because they were very social people. During the summers in Kennebunkport, they would run a book festival, kind of a book club. I once got to go up there and spend time with them on my book on Rosa Parks. And it was just a swirl of people wanting to wave at the Bushes and visit with them. And the fact that they had two sons that might be presidents someday, George W. and Jeb Bush, meant that they were still, you know, A-list celebrities. People wanted to see a Bush. It was a big deal. And so he didn't bask in the limelight. But he also wasn't a hermit. He liked to go meet everyday people and circulated, and he decided to kind of make his post-presidency about his 1,000 points of light philosophy, which at its core is about philanthropy in America, that everybody has to give. Anybody who the haves have to give to the have-nots, whether it's a church or a civic group or a billionaire, that philanthropy is one of the great engines of the U.S., and Bush kept pushing for that, while his wife was all about literacy and you know, trying to get people to read that couldn't. So they were a formidable couple out of the White House years.
Interestingly enough, one of the big stories out of the election of 2016, which saw his son Jeb Bush run and saw the wife of the man who defeated him run for office, was that late in that election season of 2016, it was reported that George H.W. Bush had told somebody at a party that he was voting for Hillary Clinton. What did that say to you about the man?
Well, I later found out about that story that it's a bit of a mystery. He definitely did not vote for Trump. I think he, in the end, the year before his death here, he'd like to not say that I just didn't vote for Trump, meaning he may have written in somebody and didn't vote for Hillary Clinton. I'm not sure we'll ever know. But he had no use for Donald Trump. You know, it's a very obscure fact, but in the 1980s, in 88, when Bush picked Dan Quayle to be his vice president, Trump was lobbying for himself as a New York real estate developer to be the VP for Bush. And Bush just mocks it. Like, can you believe that horrible self-promoter Donald Trump thinks he should be a VP? What a fool. Mm-hmm. And so there's no love lost between Donald Trump and Bush 41. And so there was relish in 2016 when Donald Trump got to do some payback on the Bushes by saying the Iraq War of W was a waste of resources, one of the biggest mistakes ever, and laughed at the House of Bush. And, you know, he had a chip on his shoulder, Donald Trump, about the Eastern establishment, about the Ivy League elites, particularly Yale, Harvard, Princeton group. And so, you know, Trump just disdained really what Bush has stood for. And so it's very magnanimous of Bush 41 to do the right thing and have Trump come to his funeral memorial service. He is not going to speak at the service, but he'll be there. I say it's the right thing because Bush 41's whole life is about helping whoever the sitting president is succeed. And by snubbing Trump the way McCain did and Barbara Bush did, it would have sent a very negative message about the institution of the presidency and only would have added to our tumultuous political divide we're experiencing right now.
Before we get to where his place in history will be, of course, Barbara Bush, as you just mentioned, died back in April, and we saw him show up in a wheelchair at age 94 to shake hands with people passing by her coffin. What has the last 6 months of his life been like without Barbara?
It's been hard losing Barbara, and having Parkinson's disease is a terrific challenge. He was regularly going into Methodist Hospital in Houston with problems of just clearing phlegm out of his nasal system and chest, and a kind of permanent feeling of pneumonia, fatigue, depletion. He did get excited after Barber died to go up to Maine, so he got one summer up there, down memory lane, seeing his Maine friends, looking at the ocean side, getting out on the fresh, you know, breathing the fresh air of the Atlantic, a little bit of going out at sea. And that meant a lot to him. Since the fall, when he got back to Houston, it's been kind of a red alert situation. He was Copus Menace, meaning he recognized people, could talk to them. There was no real dementia or something like that, but his memory was slipping. The week he died, he was able to have some private time with Barack Obama. And then, of course, James Baker was there shortly before he died, and they got to reminisce a little and talk about, "I'll see you in heaven soon." I thought Baker used the perfect phrase when he said he had a gentle death, and if only all of us could have such a gentle death. And so it was like some couples that were together once for decades. Once he lost his other half, I think a little bit of his will to live and keep on going may have left him, but at 94, his body was pretty ravaged by Parkinson's.
You know, it's kind of interesting in a way, the last presidents, because it is a big news event when a president passes away. Nixon had had a stroke and had been in the hospital, and Reagan, of course, had Alzheimer's, and Ford had been in the hospital, in and out of the hospital. So we kind of knew this was coming, but Friday night, we, of course, 94 and having Parkinson's, we knew he had not been well, but there had not been a lot of news that this certainly was imminent, as it was.
Well, anytime somebody dies, we're always shocked, even if we know it's coming soon, because you never know the hour, and you never know when you're dealing, particularly with people in their 80s or 90s, if that's the last time you're going to see them when you have a conversation. And so there was a kind of people knowing that he was struggling, but there was also a philosophy that he might be living for a few more years. So it did kind of shock the system a little bit when it happened. But immediately the Bush family did the right thing and said, we're going to make this week a celebration of Bush 41. Because after all, most of our listeners here would take 94. You know, that's a full life. Had great memories, adventures, was happy. He believed in the afterlife. He was a man of faith. And we all have to prepare for the inevitable. And so I think he did that very, very well. And people in Houston were doing regular reports about his health going up and down. Ever since September, when he got back into town from Maine, I don't want to call it hospice, but there was a extreme amount of nurses and doctors surrounding him and trying to keep him going. So, there was a foreshadowing that the end was pretty near.
His legacy is an interesting one. I've watched all the coverage, as everybody has, and read everything over the weekend. He was a one-term president. He was defeated, but yet his son became president in his lifetime. That's only happened one other time. He was good on foreign affairs, but a lot of people don't feel he was great on social affairs. A lot of talk about that this morning, I've heard. Where does he go down in history? I've heard a lot of talk of the best one-term president we've ever had. Is that apt to say?
Well, James K. Polk's ranked higher than him, and he was a one-term president. So when we do the best one-term ever, it's usually our taking our own contemporary times a little too congratulatory. I work with the C-SPAN presidential poll, and we rank him in around the middle. He's usually ranked around number 20 of American presidents. That's not Mount Rushmore status. That's not going to earn you your face on currency. It's sort of a B-plus greatest president, with the idea that it may have been an A-plus in foreign affairs and a C-plus in domestic affairs. And in the end, Ronald Reagan was the dominant Republican figure of his era. You know, Reagan is still the heart and soul of the modern Republican Party. Bush is being seen as, for the long resume, a little bit like Jimmy Carter's going to be, meaning all of this public service for so long, you know, 58 combat missions in World War II and head of the CIA, a congressman, you know, there for the big votes in, of the Great Society years and vice president for Reagan 8 years. I could go on and on with the resume, and it's remarkable. And so he's going to be seen as an important president, but I would not put him in the same category as Theodore Roosevelt or FDR or John Kennedy or Ronald Reagan.
You know, it's interesting, Douglas. What fascinates me is obviously Reagan won 2 terms, and certainly his son, W. Bush, won 2 terms, and we'll see what happens with President Trump. But those two presidents, Republican, since 1980, both had strong associations with President Bush, Vice President to Ronald Reagan, father of W. Bush. And yet, if I looked at it, and tell me if I'm wrong here, it seemed like that H.W. Bush was the more hands-on, understood the world better than the other two. We know he ranks above his son in those polls. Does he rank above Reagan?
No. Ronald Reagan was truly the great communicator. And the fact is that Reagan, after he was shot in an assassination attempt in March of 1981, kind of got a honeymoon from criticism for a while. And people thought his evil empire and tear down the wall rhetoric was over the top, too hawkish. But the amount of successful diplomacy he did with Mikhail Gorbachev and Reagan's visits to Reykjavik or Moscow and the like were quite remarkable. And so when Margaret Thatcher talks about the Cold War, for example, she'll say Ronald Reagan won the Cold War without firing a single shot. Thatcher forgets Grenada, the invasion of 1983, or Libya. So there were shots fired in that period. But the point is made. Reagan goes down as a large figure. And, you know, when you're running for president right now in the Republican Party, it's you almost like a station of the cross. You've got to go to the Reagan Library and stand there on the hill in California of Ronald Reagan, or visit his ranch home in Santa Barbara. There isn't that feeling in Republican politics about going to Kenny Bunkport or where's the Bush condo in Houston kind of thing. And so it's just that Reagan is that large of political figure. Bush will be seen more in the light, I think, of presidents like Jimmy Carter and Gerald Ford. Honest, high integrity factor, did a lot of things well. Carter, for example, was a one-termer, but did the Panama Canal treaties and Camp David Accords, recognized People's Republic of China, injected human rights into our foreign policy. The point is, with a one-term president, you can make the case for and laundry list their accomplishments, but we don't call the 1970s or 80s or 90s the age of Bush. In these regards, his son, by serving as 8 years, was a more dominant political figure on the front game as president than his father. But his father ranks higher in history than his son. His father is liked by the New York Times crowd, the Washington Post, meaning moderate Democrats love 41 and they don't like 43. And in media culture, that matters. And 41 is what if you're a Obama Democrat right now, you're saying Bush 41 is the way a Republican should be. By embracing 41, you're criticizing 43 and Trump.
It's very interesting. Before we part ways, is there anything we don't know about George Bush? Something, an obscure fact that we haven't heard in the last few days?
Well, there's one aspect of on his domestic front that stands out as a bit of an anomaly, and it doesn't get a lot of coverage. But, you know, the Clean Air Act of 1990 was quite remarkable. Bush, the man who made his fortune with the oil industry in Texas, the Zapata oil and all of this, ended up turning against the oil and gas lobby, pushing for the Clean Air Act of 1990 to attack acid rain, ozone depletion. He was worried about what today we call climate change, wanted to be seen as a leader on making sure people didn't suffer from respiratory problems due to dirty air. And in that bit of championing of that particular issue in a progressive way, he deserves to be seen as one of those. And he had a very fairly progressive EPA under William Riley. He should be able to be seen as a pretty good conservation president. And it's, to me, ironic because he was an oil and gas man at heart.
You know, one of the great ironies of this whole thing, I think, is that when we do look of the 20th century television and every president that has come since, W. Bush had the Iraq War, and that was in everybody's face in Katrina. Ronald Reagan had Iran-Contra, Nixon, Watergate, Ford, the pardon. They all had their crosses to bear. It didn't seem like, and certainly Trump has his crosses to bear, it doesn't seem like George Bush had that kind of cross. Am I wrong about that?
I think that's correct, because politics wasn't the end all. It hurt when he lost in 1992, but he went on knowing that he would live a good life because his family life was so strong and his friendship pool was so deep. And there's not, you know, unfortunately for Bush, the soundbite of his 4 years of 41 is "Read my lips, no new taxes." That's what's the soundbite most remembered. If you go back and looked at Bush's inaugural in 1989, it's one of the most brilliantly written inaugural speeches in U.S. history. He talks about the new breeze of democracy coming our way, and it's just really well done inaugural. Nobody remembers it. It just didn't have that soundbite value. So who are the presidents that soar with the bite, the audio clip that you could play on radio? Is FDR with "Nothing to Fear But Fear Itself"? John F. Kennedy, "That's not what your country can do for you, but what you can do for your country." Ronald Reagan, "Mr. Gorbachev, tear this down this wall." Bush 41, "Read my lips, no new taxes." And so it limits this ability to soar forward in history because of that. Because I would ask you, and you're a very astute interviewer and great commentator, what do we really know about Benjamin Harrison's administration? What's remembered about, you know, the work of Grover Cleveland? Who was Grover? If I quiz people and listeners, who's Grover Cleveland's cabinet? People forget. So 100, 200, 300 years from now, Bush will be seen a little more like Grover Cleveland and Benjamin Harrison type than somebody like Kennedy or FDR or Reagan, who were able to communicate an era via speeches, news conferences. They were telegenic and used their media forms of their moment with great skill. Lyndon Johnson didn't do well with media culture. He has that great civil rights speech, "We Shall Overcome," an important one. But he's also hampered with the Vietnam War clips, and Gerald Ford and Jimmy Carter were not telegenic, and neither was Bush 41.
Before we part ways, there's two things, and I appreciate the time. This has been fascinating, and I'm thank you so much for staying over. But when I talked to Helen Thomas, who was a pretty good friend, White House press corps, and Sarah McClendon, who was there during the Bush years as well, along with a lot of other presidents, they both kind of felt the same thing. Neither one of them really liked W. Bush, but they said they didn't know how to frame H.W. Bush. Not liked, beloved, not disliked. And interestingly enough, from a historian's standpoint, Douglas, he didn't write a memoir. I'm sure he was offered money to. I don't know that there are diaries. Is there going to be another story on H.W. Bush like there had been with Reagan?
That's a really good question. He did these little tape snippets that can be construed as diaries, but nothing earth-shattering. He co-wrote a book called A World Transformed with Brett Scowcroft But it was just some, you know, policy nuggets, nothing memorable. And that goes to the point I was trying to make. Bush fashioned himself as a man of many hats, but what they all added up to was he was a Washington, D.C. insider. He knew how a government worked. He knew he operated on a Rolodex and friendships. He wrote all the thank you notes to people and the like, and it allowed him, he was really training himself to be a ambassador or a bureaucrat, where you might want to stay on for another administration. You know, there's some ambassadors that will be ambassador for Bush and Clinton. You know, it doesn't matter the party. He built his career like that. And so once he got the VP nod, and the, you know, his big role was trying not to make enemies in Washington, doing back channel work. He wasn't a gossip. He really thought gossip could be mean, and so in the black art, so he tended to be pretty positive. And so he didn't have a lot of people that disliked him, which is a great virtue in life, but sometimes to be great, you have to have enemies. And you know, FDR went after, you know, Wall Street, and, you know, John F. Kennedy put the moon challenge that we're going to the moon by the end of the decade. Bush, to his credit, is going to be seen as the president that ended the Berlin Wall, ended the Cold War, and the artifact of his presidency is the punk of the Berlin Wall. That is a souvenir all over the country now. You can go to public policy institutes, libraries, there's a big piece of the Berlin Wall. And somehow, by telling the story of the wall, will be the story of George Herbert Walker Bush, because he's a cold warrior. And it's a style of operation, because in the Cold War, Reagan was unique for being inflammatory, but Bush, like many cold warriors, were trying to do back-channel negotiations with China and Russia. There was something Nixonian about Bush in that way, that even though we don't like Russia and China, we got to get along with them, and our role is to contain them and make sure we don't go to war. And so, you know, he was operating on those kind of, you know, back eddies of cultural exchanges and visiting friendships. And if somebody from China to Russia came to America, you'd take him out for dinner. And he was a great Cold War gentleman and diplomat. Who happened to be the president who gets to claim he was there when the Cold War ended and the United States, at least seemingly now, won.
Mm. The funeral for President George Herbert Walker Bush in Washington will be on Wednesday, and in Texas will be on Thursday in the afternoon, if you would like to watch those. We've been chatting with legendary historian Douglas Brinkley, who you can catch, well, by the way, check out all of his books. They're all great, and you can catch him on CNN, which is always a pleasure. Douglas, thank you so much for the time. This was very interesting.
I really appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you. Douglas Brinkley, Ed Asner, coming up next hour.
Smoke, it encircled his head like a wreath. He had a broad face and a little round belly that shook when he laughed like a bowl full of jelly. He was chubby and a right jolly old elf.